Hi, I'm Kate Carpolo, a writer based in Sacramento, California. I've spent the past few months talking to Democrats about how they've been feeling since Donald Trump got elected. Not so well, it turns out, with lots of stories about depression, trouble sleeping, and needing to check out. I call it Trump trauma. It's real, and it's had many stages, starting with post-election shock. But Democrats have definitely turned the corner, as people also talked about defiance, a sense of purpose, even hope. And they're not just talking, they're taking action, getting organized. So welcome to my podcast, How Democrats Are Reeling and Dealing with Trump Trauma. No doubt, when Donald Trump won, most Democrats were shocked. Here's Beverly Johnson. She works with foster kids, and she's the mother of two teenage boys.
I think initially I was dumbfounded by the election and kind of a little like sideswiped and felt like sucker punched.
It didn't take long for shock to turn to sadness. Here's May Saeed, who runs Emerge California, an organization that trains Democratic women to run for office.
I think all of us were in a very similar place last year after the election where, you know, it just felt very grim and very gray.
Jennifer Manuel is a leadership consultant based in Sacramento. She makes the point that the sadness wasn't just about losing an election.
I think there's something to be said for mourning the loss of what could have been, of seeing a woman ascend to the highest office in the U.S., of what that would have meant for, you know, telling all of our daughters, you could be president too, and meaning it.
Shane Carter works as an outreach coordinator at UC Berkeley. She tells a story that really touched me and shows how deep the sadness went, how it showed up in day-to-day interactions where you wouldn't necessarily expect it. Her story starts a few days after the election when she was closing down a campaign office.
So I went across the street to the landlord to get the key for it, and he sent me across the street with a young man who I'd guess was like 19 or 20 years old, a young Yemeni American man. And this kid didn't know me at all. And so we're standing there on the corner waiting for the light to change. And he said, "How are you doing?" And I said, "You know, I'm upset. I'm pretty sad about what happened." And I said, "How are you doing?" And he started crying. And he said, "I just, like, my stomach hurts all the time. I'm so worried for what's going to happen to my family." And I thought, like, the idea that this 19-year-old young man, who under normal circumstances, I would not expect this kid to be like that emotive, was very affecting. And I felt like it was horrible. I felt sad for him and I felt sad for me.
Shane also talks about the sadness she felt as an African-American. Her story starts at a photo session and the message she was intent on sharing with President Barack Obama.
And what I said was that I wanted to thank him for running for president, and that working on his campaign and seeing him get elected was the first time in my life that I had truly felt like an American. Not an American but, or an American in some special category, but just an American. And so I think what's interesting and what's particularly sad about Trump is that I don't know whether I think it would have been better to have never felt that or to have felt it and then lost it.
Anger was another stage of Trump trauma, and there was a lot of it. Some targeted, a lot diffuse. Some anger seemed to motivate action, but in some cases it was nearly paralyzing. Here's Beverly Johnson again.
Mostly I've been very angry and trying to fuel my anger into something productive.
Here's Marissa Maldonado. She works at a community-based organization in Sacramento. She shared her anger about Trump's messaging.
I was angry that the messages that he sends hurt, the things that he condones oppress.
Here's Shane Carter again, and she talks about coping with anger on a daily basis.
I joke with my friends that I'm developing a certain messed up type of Buddhist practice where instead of meditating and being able to focus on nothing, that I'm developing the capacity to maintain a like near boil level of anger for increasing periods of time without like you know, that my endurance for being just furious at what's happening has increased.
And Democrats shared fears and worry about the future, our climate, our democracy, our culture. Fear was not so much a stage, but an ever-present undercurrent. Diana Williams, she's a mother of three and lived in Washington, D.C. in November 2016.
I worry that I'm not doing enough to try to fix things personally. I fear that there's so much work to be done, and we have crawled back into our corners of the ring.
Here's Rosanna Herber. She's a political activist in Sacramento.
And I'm actually very worried about the future of our country when we don't have people who are willing to stand up to power and tell them that what they're doing is wrong.
And Beverly Johnson, she talks about the change in tone in the public square.
I'm concerned at some of the ways that it's like a vitriol, it's like a hatred kind of a thing out there.
Eleanor Moses, she's a political activist in the Bay Area.
I think one of the most disturbing things with Donald Trump is that he has distorted reality. And I think that it has kind of unhinged a lot of people. And I think that people don't know what to think, you know, a lot of times. And it's just a lot of energy to process what's real and what's not.
There's no doubt that with all the shock, sadness, anger, worry, one mode of coping was, well, just to check out. Beverly Johnson sums it up.
I actually thought, I'm going to give this guy a try. Like, this is kind of, you know, his strategy going forward was to get the presidency. And so he achieved that. So I thought, okay, maybe that was part of the strategy and he was going to like let off a bit and actually maybe use that to his advantage. And what I received was just not that, you know, espousing certain things, the hatred that kind of came out. It just caused even more divide. I think initially I would be listening to the news and then I just started checking out.
Here's Shane Carter again.
I had exactly the reaction that was sort of the one by design in a lot of ways, which is that there have been so many disappointing policy changes and executive orders and tweets that I think it has had exactly the effect that it was intended to have, which is to make me want to just bury my head in the sand.
Democrats seem to be emerging from a year of Trump trauma, putting aside their despair, focusing on what needs to be done. Here's how May describes it.
I think a lot of people initially started with like the mourning and grieving process and now are finally starting to come out of that. And what the amazing thing that we're seeing is that people are coming together in their communities, right? They're identifying others who have similar interests and values with them and almost creating a camaraderie and a partnership and establishing really good relationships that are healthy and are going to get them through the next year in a positive way.
Eleanor had some specific advice about finding a lane and moving on.
It's been really overwhelming, but I think that for people who care about the future of this country, we don't have the luxury of pulling the cover over our head and tuning it out. I mean, we have to stay tuned in, and we just have to find a lane that we can get in and sustain over the long haul, and be supportive of people that are doing the work around you, and be as positive and encouraging as you can to folks, because all of us need a lot of support at this point.
As I conducted my interviews, one question came to mind that I think needs more reflection and discussion. For Democrats, what needs to happen in 2018 so it's not an emotional repeat of 2017? If Democrats want to organize, collaborate, and be effective in 2018, what do they need to do to avoid being depressed, sad, angry, or checked out? To avoid constantly being triggered by Donald Trump's atrocious tweets? What personal strategies have people identified to keep them focused, help them maintain their purpose and momentum? Based on my interviews, I think there's four strategies to keep in mind. The first is self-care. And yes, I know everyone always puts self-care on the list. It's almost trite. But in the Trump era, self-care is foundational. The people I interviewed talked about behaviors they want to change. More sleep, fewer glasses of wine, regular exercise or meditation. Others talked about limiting screen time, including cable news. Not burning out, that was a big issue. Here's Sandra Fluke, a social justice attorney based in Los Angeles.
You can't run a marathon for 4 years. Think of this as a relay race. You have to pass the baton, take turns, take a rest.
That's a great analogy. I also talked to David Shattuck, a Berkeley-based psychotherapist. He had this counsel.
In addition to the usual things we think of as self-care, such as giving ourselves a break, turning off the TV, being kind to ourselves, if you're comfortable with a spiritual practice, now might be the time to deepen it.
May Saeed adds an important reminder for Democrats as they get closer to election deadlines.
I've noticed over the last year, I function a lot better when I have space to be creative. And so urgency really doesn't, urgency drives me, but urgency doesn't necessarily mean the best results. And I think as we get closer to the deadlines that are going to naturally occur in the election cycle in 2018, we have to make sure to build out time for ourselves and take care of ourselves.
The second strategy is to have some perspective, to get out of what one person called the daily freakout. Naomi Seligman, who until recently directed communications for LA Mayor Eric Garcetti, she makes this point.
As we know, politics goes in cycles, and we just happen to be in a really challenging one right now.
David Shattuck, he counsels people to take a longer view, to find comfort in the resilience of those who have faced tough times in the past.
There are times like this in history, or worse, and we've gotten through. Even at the worst of times, people were painting and writing poetry, a sign that the human spirit can't be crushed.
The third strategy is to take action. People I talk to acknowledge their friends, family, even themselves, might still be depressed, in the doldrums, but they think it's time to pivot. Putting it bluntly, it's time to stop complaining and take action. Here's Naomi Seligman.
If you're feeling bad, doing something makes you feel better. We don't have the luxury of wallowing in our sadness right now. We owe people around us a lot more than that.
Tori Osborne, a political activist from LA, makes a similar point.
Action. That's the key to everything. If you sit on Facebook and fulminate, you might feel good for a moment, but ultimately you just make yourself crazy and have zero impact.
And because I heard it so many times, I'm going to add one more voice to the mix. Here's Diana Vasquez. She works on environmental justice issues.
Given that it's a 2018 election and saying, look, like, if you want to invest your energy and stop complaining about our president, these are different channels you can get involved, right? There's a lot of elections, local elections, congressional elections, state elections. What do you want to get involved with? They need canvassers. They need this. I just need you to be a part of it. And I can't have you complain about it and not do anything about it.
Tori Osborne believes it's critical that political action be strategic. Here she is again.
For me, it's all about the midterms and taking back the House. Like a laser, I'm focused. Nothing else matters. Now is not the time to crack the third of the electorate that's reactionary. That's self-destructive. We have to get our people to the polls, period. If 84% of those who voted for Hillary show up in November, the blue wave wins.
Like Tori, Rosanna Herber, the Sacramento political activist, plans to work on congressional midterm elections and support candidates with contributions. But she's also working very intentionally at the local level.
I really have decided to make sure that the world, the city that I live in, reflects the values that are important to me, even though they're not happening on the bigger level. In our city, we care about immigration. We care about a woman's right to control her body. We care about LGBT people. So in my own backyard, I'm wanting it to be a safe place and a reflection of the values that I have.
Taking action was a strategy everyone agreed was a constructive way to deal with Trump trauma. And before I move on to the final strategy, let's hear once more from Diana Vasquez.
Fighting for what is right is not a given. And what you thought was you know, was normal and granted to you, it's actually a privilege. And you have to fight for that.
The fourth and final strategy is to be kind. Therapist David Shattuck offers this context.
It's even more important to be kind to each other when people are trading in cruelty.
In our interview, he emphasized that kindness should literally begin at home, with your family relationships, which maybe you've noticed have gotten a bit tense in the past year, especially after you watch the news. I have to be honest, I wrestled with what role kindness should play in the world of politics. One person I talked to argued Democrats should be ruthless as they work to change the balance of power. But others argued, and I was convinced, that the messages and strategies Democrats use need to reflect their values. Otherwise, what's the point in being a Democrat? My take is that Democrats need to avoid being ruthless, but they do need to be ruthlessly strategic and focus first on the midterms. So, not ruthless, but ruthlessly strategic. Here's Marissa Maldonado. She talks about how we have to be different from Donald Trump.
Those of us who are fighting against the ideals that he represents, we have to fight in a different way if what we want is a cohesive unit of people with different backgrounds, different hurts, different understandings, and different things that we bring to the table.
And here's what May Said says.
The fear is that we're going to wake up one morning, look in the mirror, feel so righteous in our values and our beliefs and what we're fighting for, that we fail to recognize that we've turned into the thing that we have been fighting. So I think it's just really important that we make sure to take care of ourselves, recognize the humanity in each other, and then move forward with this idea of like recognizing self in others and giving space for people to share their stories, because that's what's going to be able to bring us together.
Frank Brody, in a recent New York Times column, wrote that fury isn't strategy. I agree. Fury disrupts. It doesn't lead to anything substantive or good. Kindness, on the other hand, is both a strategy and a goal. And we're going to have to be kind if we want to make American kind. Thank you for listening to this podcast. And remember, to stop reeling and start dealing with Trump trauma, start with self-care, keep your perspective, take strategic action, and be kind.